Do you have a question?
I'm talking about, wanting to ask Adam Smedow about the nature of emptiness, because in some of the teachings that I've received in other traditions also, going with this sense of emptiness is the natural arising of love and compassion, which seems to link very much with what you're saying about awareness, because it seems to me that the essence of the practice can be recognized for ourselves and perhaps in others when this artificial mind state of separation disappears. All that's left must be unconditional love. And surely that's the very essence of what you're talking about. So it's not a lack of coldness. It's not this sort of plane of awareness that we reach, which is sort of depersonalized and like Siberia. there seems to me that coming with this, certainly I feel it from you, this expression, which is very uncontrived, the natural expression of unconditional love.
Well, I think the words themselves are like, and all a word can do is really, a concept is just kind of emphasize something. You know, it's incomplete in itself. So when you talk about emptiness, that's an emphasis on, but it's incomplete in the sense that it oftentimes gives the impression of like totally empty nothingness, kind of a void, a vacuum, where. But then it also has a value in terms of pointing to just the reality of non-attachment, where we're, you know, with attachment, we're always filling up the emptiness with something. So, you know, we live in a world where we're always creating the world and ourselves and the future and memories of the past. So we're always filling up the emptiness with something. And then, and so the aim of mindfulness is to see, you know, we don't have to do that. We don't have to keep, you know, this compulsion, this obsessive habit of just filling everything up all the time. And that just emptiness itself is peacefulness. That we are no longer feel this obsessive need to fill it, but then you think of like non-self or anatta, which is emphasized in the Theravada and Pali teachings, and that can be seen as, you know, like you shouldn't have a self, or you know, one can form a view about self as something obstructive and something wrong or bad about self. And actually, anatta is an emptiness of the same thing. You know, it's not the self is created. If we're just creating ourselves endlessly into the emptiness, then we don't know what we're doing. Then we're caught in this vortex of samsara. Or say unconditioned love is you know, if I create you know, ideas of love and have preferences, I love these people more than those and that, then that's coming from the self, from the need to fill up the space, you know, with these are my people, those are my enemies, and the division takes place. And then say conditioned love is always, you know, I love you when you do what I say, but if you disobey me, I don't love you anymore. So then so then it's a condition, you know, and then you're punished for disobeying, you know, even in the Old Testament, you know, God would punish the Jews terribly for just looking at another god or something. You see? So this is where we get our cues about you know, God and this dualism of right and wrong and what you should and shouldn't do. But in unconditioned love, you know, think this emptiness, since it includes everybody, everything, you know, it is, and there's no, then it doesn't mean that there's no conditions, but the underlying, that which is interconnected is love. And then the conditions are changing according to other conditions. If we only know the conditions, then we're caught in the changingness of everything. And we forget, we don't recognize unconditioned love anymore. So we can hold the ideal, like I found in my own case, like unconditioned, like with metta, for example, you always start, ahang sukhito homi, translated, may I abide in well-being. So the clue, the emphasis is on having this towards yourself, this unconditioned love towards yourself. Now these are words again. How can I love myself? And you know, and if I start thinking about it, I get even more confused. But in terms of unconditioned love, it's like it unconditioned love is like, you know, it what, no matter what I do, no matter how bad I am or lawless or cruel or mean, this unconditioned love is still there. You know, it's not, it doesn't remove itself when I misbehave. Well, what is that then but awareness, mindfulness? And it's a matter of you know, so this I had the insight, like when I recognize this, then I can, you know, I feel you know, totally connected to this universe. You know, even as a separate entity, as this being, this personality, it belongs. Even my bad thought, even the mosquitoes and the demons, they all belong. Everything belongs. And so we hear, you know, about moral judgments and strong views about what is natural and unnatural, and we have our preferences for, you know, what is natural is good, and if that's unnatural, that shouldn't exist. But unconditioned love doesn't judge according to whether it's natural or unnatural. Everything. Now just recognize the profundity of that. Like in metta practice, the loving kindness then is not just reserved for the good ones, but you know, loving kindness for the Lord of Death and the aliens and the evil forces and the beings in hell and so forth, as well as all the angels and the good ones. So now, and it's not proportionate either. You know, you're not saying 90% goes to the good ones, I'll designate 10% for the bad ones. It's unconditioned. And so then, in terms of embracing everything, unconditioned love has no preferences. It's what holds it all together. It's what connects us all. You see, so when we're mindful, we actually begin to operate from unconditioned love rather than from personal agendas or biases. And you see, when and that's why it's so important to recognize it, because it's real. It's not just a romantic ideal or some high-minded metaphysical theory. When you test it out, like they're testing out this mindfulness, and towards myself, towards the things that come and go in my own mind, towards the emotions, towards the memories, it allows me to accept whatever I'm thinking or feeling as it is, without judging it. Now, if I forget this, then I tend to, then I start coming from, I'm a Buddhist monk of 40 years. Then I get into my, I shouldn't think like that. Or, that's a bad feeling. Or, I should be, you know, I hope nobody notices something because, you know, they'd be disillusioned that such a grand monk as myself is such a mean thought. And things like this. So there's always, there's a judgment. You know, my character, my superego, using Freudian terms, is the biggest tyrant in the universe. I'm sure it's more tyrannical than your superegos. I've got the most tyrannical superego than anyone here. And what I'm saying is like it's very judgmental. You know, I know what's right and how things should be. You know, and I know how I should be. And you're brought up in this very idealistic way. And so the judgment's always towards my humanity is I can never be like the ideal. So I'm never going to win this battle. Superego, it just goes on, you know. And I've seen it, you know, even no matter how careful I am with the monastic discipline and how diligent I am a meditator, the superego still can find something wrong with me. Well, after a while, you begin to realize you can't trust that's what tyranny is. You know, you tyrannize this. It's reasonable and it's intelligent, so therefore it's intimidating. And then you know, I started like, you know, I was on the emotional level. This is one reason before I ordained. You know, I realized emotionally I was a very immature 30-year-old. You know, so this was frightening because I was 30 years old and I still had emotions of like a child of 4 or 5. You know, and this was, and I didn't, you know, just I felt this futility, like total despair because I had to pretend, you know, I'm an adult male and put on this, you know, I could present myself well in society, but inside there was all this other. And so then there was a lot of trying to suppress it, and then a lot of judgment, tyrannical, that's bad, that's immature, that's childish, you shouldn't feel like that. And on and on like that. So then through meditation, I began actually to see the emotions with loving kindness. You know, well, before I'd say they were childish and immature, I began to accept them for what they are and not judge them. And then the result was that the problem dissolved. Because the problem was always the battle between the superego and the emotional realities of my karma. And so this is like this internal conflict, the war begins, you know. You know, from both sides, they both start from a righteous position. Nobody intentionally evil, delighting in destruction, just out of malice and malevolence. When we commit evil acts, it's oftentimes out of righteousness. Out of, you know, some kind of grasping of we're right, you're wrong. If you're wrong, then we've got to get rid of you. Well, there's a, you know, they've convinced of that they're right. But in that righteousness, there's no unconditioned love. So righteousness is very divisive, you know. Even though it's right, it's not really right. You know, and it's and because life isn't like that. You know, it's not the way I would like it to be if everything were right according to my opinion. But life is like this, includes everything. includes everything, all the things I don't like even. They belong. And the pests and the terrorists and so forth. So then one begins to then applying that to yourself first, you know, to your own emotional habits and fears and desires, is actually, you know, modern psychotherapy is moving in this direction, is realizing that if you're going to really resolve a lot of emotional problems, just by analyzing them doesn't work. There's this acceptance of them, non-judgmental, unconditioned acceptance of them for what they are, and then the conditions, you're recognizing their cessation, because then you're allowing them to cease. You're allowing them to you're not just resisting and creating more karma with them. You had a question?
Well, I was thinking of more extreme situations where people are in prison, tortured, the slave trade, slave. It's very difficult to attain this state when you're in the depth of suffering so severe. What would you say?
Yeah, well, extreme. You know, very few can even develop it when it's not extreme. But, you know, I mean, some people, you know, the more they've been tortured and pushed, the more aware they become. I'm not justifying this. But, you know, it is, you know, like there are many wrong things, wrong conditions, things that shouldn't be. And so it's not a denial of this. But just by that alone, by hating them and eradicating them, oftentimes we create more conditions that never get resolved. Like you can see, a lot of the problems, you know, the recurring wars, the ethnic rivalries, the race hatreds, anti-Semitism, and so forth. These are all things that have never really been resolved, you know, so they keep coming back because...
You don't have slavery anymore, it's not true. Not in the book.
Not, it's not, well, now it's not legal. Which is an improvement, yes. But it's still a slave. And, but I mean, now, I mean, in the old days, it was legal, you know, you could have, at least in England it wasn't, was it? But in the States, it was legal till the 1860s. You know, it was unquestioned. But now, I think, you know, from what I hear, you know, I hear a lot of it here in England. Like in prostitution, things like this, where they're just nothing but slaves, really. And this is happening now, but yet it's not legal. You can't justify it on that level. And it's, but you know, then as we develop, as we say cultivate more, then our relationship even to slavery or the evil forces is one not of judgment and of hatred, but of, you know, compassion, a willingness to get to the basic of to the root of the problem, which is, you know, because people do these evil things out of fear and ignorance, you know, and as long as, you know, so they're learning how to survive in a system, and I come from a very fortunate background, you know, where I could take a lot for granted, but when you hear the stories of other people, you know, being, you know, in like in Albania, places like this, and the street children and all that, I mean, it's just breaks your heart to think of how what that must do to your psyche, you know, to be unloved, rejected, and just survival, learning to survive by any means. And of course, the human beings have incredible adaptability. I mean, they survive under all the most horrific conditions. But it's a lack of this sense of compassion, you know, that it's not just trying to, you know, to get sentimentally involved with it and righteously indignant, but to develop that ability that we all have to where the wrongs or the unfairness in a society can be addressed in a way that the actual thing can be resolved rather than just repressed again or where we can delude ourselves that it's no longer a problem. Oftentimes that's, we like to buy into the delusion. Well, that's, we solved that long ago. It's no longer a problem. Oh, thanks. We can forget about it. And that we can dismiss things because they're too painful to dwell on. And in one's own, now the real test is in yourself to be able to see what, you know, the anger or the fear that is very, these are natural kind of primal emotions, you know, that we all have as human beings, as mammals, you know. So, you know, dogs, cats have fear and anger. So these are like primal energies that we experience through this form. And then on the level of delusion, we create it into a personal problem. We don't understand these energies. The superego tends to judge them as bad. You're bad because you get angry. You shouldn't be afraid. You're just a wimp. You should be brave and not just be a coward frightened by these things. And so the judgments from above can be very harsh, very, very cruel. And they're right in a way, you know, but in terms of understanding the nature, the way things really are, then, you know, our sense of awareness of them is not approving or judging, but it's a willingness to accept something. To really understand something, you have to accept it. You know, have to hold this and look at it and study it to recognize it as Perrier bottled at source. You know, if I just don't bother to look, then I, you know, if I've got some kind of fear of it, then I just get rid of it, throw it away. But if I accept it, and, you know, accepting what I don't like even doesn't mean approving of it, but it means I can actually begin to acknowledge its right to exist at this moment and let it be. Then it naturally ceases, you know, condition. We're noticing the changingness of conditions. Yes?
Buddhism, or at least from what I hear from your lecture, it seems to have very close links to modern psychotherapy. Very strong links in terms of, we just mentioned positive regard, or unconditional positive regard, and empathy and congruence and that kind of stuff. Very, very much like the humanist type of psychotherapy out of the works of people like Carl Rogers. Where do you think Buddhism as a spiritual pursuit or as a religion, where do you think it differs? In which major ways do you think it does differ from psychotherapy, counseling?
Well, its whole aim is enlightenment. You know, it's where I think psychotherapy tends towards, that's not its purpose. It tends towards releasing tension and suffering. But it's like psychotherapy to a Buddhist is more like a skillful means. So same faculty where you're developing awareness and unconditional acceptance, things like this, these would be healthy things to do, even if you have no interest in ultimate enlightenment. But then, and say on the religious side, Buddhism as a religion, then the religion is a convention, a form of some sort that binds you. That if you it's a vehicle to use towards recognizing or realizing ultimate reality. And so, in terms, then in that, the way I've defined religion in this aspect, then Buddhism is a religion. And it's also psychology. I mean, Dhamma really covers everything. You can teach Buddhism as philosophy, as psychology, as science, as religion, because it's about the way things are. It's not an imposition of thought or ideas onto something that you accept. But the whole point is awakened attention observing, and then the teachings themselves are not to be grasped as things to believe in, but as pointers at this present moment. So that's in my own practice over these years is always using this, like Buddha right now. What is Buddha right now? Asking these kind of questions. Because part of being a Buddhist monk is you take refuge in the Buddha. And of course that can be seen in just a convention, that's part of Theravada Buddhism, and you kind of have various takes on it or ideas, and as some kind of Buddha force in the universe, or the great sage of the past, or something. But I'm more interested in using that word Buddha, not as to refer to something in the past, but as here and now. So what is Buddha right now? And it's awareness. It can only be this. Within a separate form, like Buddha, you can make images. So you have Buddha images. So you have Buddha, like Gautama the Buddha, and you have Dipankara Buddha, and so forth. You have the different 28 Buddhas and of the past, and Buddhas, and that, but then you can just see them in terms of historical reference or some kind of traditional views about the history of Buddhism. Or when you're actually taking refuge in Buddha, to me it means awake, being aware now. So then the word Buddha actually, when I hear the word, just somebody says the word Buddha, it just reminds me, not just in terms of, was there really a Buddha? Was that, because in any religion as old as this, there can be all kinds of doubts about, was there ever really a Gautama the Buddha? Was this maybe some kind of cult in India? the questions about whether Jesus Christ actually lived or not. And so you can get caught into, wanting historical accuracy and proof. But it doesn't matter. Even if they could prove there is no such thing as Gautama the Buddha, actually the teaching works. So, I mean, it's not, that wouldn't, if they could accurately prove scientifically through the Akashic record there was no Gautama the Buddha, the teaching that we call Buddhism still works. I mean, it doesn't really matter. Because Buddha then is this awareness. And then in terms of the Buddha, like each one of us is experiencing consciousness from a form, so you're experiencing consciousness from your form, your body. So right now I'm in your consciousness reality. You're in my consciousness. And so we begin to just notice the way it is. And yet on a conventional level, we don't notice that. We think we're two men sitting here in the same room, and I'm the one giving the talk, and you're asking the question. Playing, you know, the, on the conventional level is our reality. But this is where we're challenging, just being attached and caught into the superficiality of conventional reality towards investigating to a deeper understanding of the way it is. So in ultimate reality, you know, in terms of experience here and now, you are the center. And in terms of your experience right now, you are the center of the universe. Or each one of us at this point, this is the center point. Now, that is that megalomania or grandiosity, or is the truth? Because let's face it, you are always experiencing. You experience life from this point, you know, from your within the form of your body, the conscious form. Now, what you put into that consciousness can be all kinds of delusions, or through awareness, you begin to not create delusions, but trust more in the awareness, which is a universal intelligence, not where you create your personal identity through memory, through attachments, through conventions.
I'm very intrigued by this, because from my own experience, because I've actually worked as a therapist in the for a while past, what seems to happen is that people, there's a point when a person clearly has touched something very real for them in a process of what we might call a psychotherapeutic environment. And that seems to be exactly the same as what happens when we touch this moment in meditation or in conversation. We don't know how it happens in a kind of Buddhist environment when we feel this sense of complete presence. I think it's the same thing. So these things come together. To me, it seems a successful, in inverted commas, outcome psychotherapeutically if somebody feels really whole and connected right now in the present moment. Yeah, without being in denial of anything. So it's a process where you can accept, as you're saying, everything as it actually is, without these superegoic judgments. So isn't that, Ajahn Smita, where it kind of comes together? That if one's really in a good therapeutic situation, the word therapy is getting an improvement, and the improvement is actually the enlightenment of being present. So I'm contradicting what you're saying in a way, because surely, if you are being connected and you are feeling present, you're becoming whole, healed, and that very moment of being completely present is enlightenment.
Right. But they, you know, like, I mean, there's different psychotherapy. A term that covers all kinds of different methods, you know. So I can't speak from, you know, every form of psychotherapy because it, you know, I don't know them really. But the ones that come here, or the ones I know, you know, and I met. Like, there's a lot of interest in among psychotherapists here in Britain in Buddhist meditation. So, and then I attended a conference several years ago of psychotherapists, and their whole, I was a keynote speaker, and what they wanted, well, the whole subject of this conference was mindfulness. And so that was very, you know, it gave me a lot of hope for psychotherapy, because I'd never heard them ever mention mindfulness before. You know, always tended to be more analytical, and so that's why I feel, you know, that certain forms of psychotherapy, and then they're more of, you know, they're just naturally moving toward a more, what we would call a Buddhist perspective. Because the Buddhist perspective isn't like a patent title to something, but it's it's a natural perspective. The more you pay attention, the more you understand. And whether you want to call that Buddhism or not is something, you know, up to you. But I mean, it's like when you're using the Buddhist conventions, and so I call myself a Buddhist monk because that's a convention. But in terms of awareness, doesn't mean that that's Buddhist. The Buddha was pointed to, you know, used the words, but awareness is natural to us. And you'd be, even the most heedless person would be dead if they were never, ever mindful. I mean, you just don't survive. You know, but it's in recognizing awareness. And so that, because we can, you know, when you're driving a car or you're doing something dangerous, you have to be mindful. You have to, you know, have that openness to the conditions around you. In sports, I imagine, you know, like playing football, you have to really be mindful to know where everything is, where who's who, and where the ball is. You can't think about it, can you? In the fast movement of modern football, there's a certain amount of awareness necessary to keep the perspective clear, just on that level of the challenge of the game. But then, you know, as soon as the game's over, maybe they all go and get drunk. I don't know what they do after, but they but it wouldn't surprise me. And the where on the conditions for awareness are there, you know, it's just naturally, you know, if you're going to get involved in that way, then you have to be aware. But they may not understand it themselves. You see, with the Buddhist teaching, it's actually using terminologies not as things to grasp, but as pointers and you know, to get us to really, to encourage us, to empower us to awaken and observe. And so you have like the Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness teachings like this. That are really just ways the Buddha pointed to developing or recognizing this natural state, which isn't, you can't claim it as any kind of religious prerogative. So this is where, it's where all the religious conventions merge, you know, where the convention's no longer necessary. But if, you know, with the problem with religious conventions, oftentimes we identify and attach to the convention so strongly, we can never get beyond it. So some people criticize religion as a kind of opiate of the people or blinding, you know, keeps you ignorant and blind. And, of course, you know, you can say it's the religion's fault, but is it really? It's a misuse of it. It's not recognizing how to use a religious convention for awakened attention. Now, like with the emphasis on faith, I have a very skeptical nature, so I can't believe it. Somebody says you have to believe this, I can't do it. I couldn't, you know, when Christianity, I found it very difficult for me to just accept things that they tell you you have to believe in. And because my nature is like this, somehow I just can't do it. It's not even that I don't want to do it, it's I can't. And when I was younger, I even tried to do it, you know, willfully believe what I'm supposed to believe in, but couldn't do that. So then the Buddhism, what attracted me to Buddhism was the fact they didn't make that demand. you know, so it was open for investigation. And this immediately appealed to me. You know, something in me responded to that, because I can do this. I can do. But I had enough. Say, I had enough faith, interest, faith. In the beginning, because I was such a skeptic, I doubted whether Buddhism was, you know, I thought maybe it's just another one of those religious things that gets you nowhere, or, you know, just an intellectual exercise for the brain. But I had, there's something in me, like an interest enough to pursue it, then try to find out more about it. And as I found out more about it, and the more I began to practice with it, and apply it inwardly to my own experience of life, then the amount of trust or faith in it increased. So when I started out with a skeptical questioning and what just enough interest to get me started, say now, after 50 years of Buddhism, you know, I have total trust in it, you know, 100%, because I've actually, you know, over the years, put it to the test, you know, to see if it, you know, not just expecting some reward in the next life or a better birth or that, but actually, you know, in the life that I experience, in the ups and downs of, you know, of the conventional world, I apply it. So, like when a period in my life where I was being criticized a lot by other monks, and I felt, you know, very personally, you know, I felt very hurt and offended by a lot of the criticisms. Well, then putting that experience into with mindfulness, you know, rather than the tendency was to think it's not fair, and, you know, to feel sorry for myself or to blame the people who criticize me. But I also knew better than that. It was the time to really be aware of the reaction, the emotional reaction I was having, and through that, you know, through the kind of willingness to accept the pain and the, without creating it into anything more than just receiving it, you know, the amount of faith in this way, because I began to see, I've fully acknowledged the fact that I create the suffering out of ignorance. You know, that if I'm heedless, then I create my misery. And it's no longer a theory, it's just recognized every time I'm miserable, it's because I'm clinging to something. So then it's obvious, don't cling to anything. Yes?
I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about the difference between inquiry and doubt as a hindrance. Relationship between them, and I mean, you said it changed the illness, so you developed more faith, but at the same time, it's not in a place of inquiry.
Well, that's like doubt is one of the hindrances, but it, like anything, it can be used. You know, if you just think I shouldn't doubt, or you can't get anywhere with that. If you're a doubter, then you start from where you are, the way you are, and recognizing the way you are isn't a judgment about how you should be, but it's a willingness to accept, you know, even if you don't like the way you are, to accept that for what it is. And because I have this skeptical tendency, I quickly caught on to the fact that doubt was going to be my means. And of course, you know, skillful means, because this, I've no problem with creating doubts. And how to use doubt as a skillful means. And the I remember in the early years of my early monastic life, I did a lot of, tried to do a lot of the samadhi practices, and I could, you know, I realized that by concentrating my mind, and then I could, you know, I could really get very, very tranquil, very refined states. But immediately I started doubting it, they were gone. You know, so, and because I'm such a cynic, that I remember, you know, really experimenting with that, that how ephemeral and unshakable those states were. And so I, you know, I really lost interest in doing that, because, I mean, it's like, it didn't seem what I needed, you know. Where when I started really doubting, intentionally doubting. Now, what happens when you doubt? You know, you ask yourself a question. You know, like, who am I? Now, if you just listen to yourself questioning, you're not asking somebody else for the answer. But you're using a question because a question is a form of doubt. Who am I? There's a doubt there, isn't there? And so you begin to notice. When you intentionally inquire like that, then you're also intentionally ask the question, but you're also aware. You're not really interested in an answer to the question, but in the state of suspension that happens. The thoughts cease at that moment. There's a doubt, a gap, and you begin to include that in conscious experience, the gaps between things, where if you don't notice that, then you are, you know, who am I? Well, I'm Ajahn Sumedho, of course, isn't it? And well, you already know that on the conventional level. I'm not interested in asserting my Ajahn Sumedho-ness is a kind of big deal, but you know, in terms of the who am I, or using any question, like those koans in Zen, you know, those conundrums they ask, you know, that you can't, you know, that your intellect can't answer, but you're always doubting, you know, your thinking mind stops. Now, then that you're aware of that. The awareness then starts connecting both with thinking and with non-thinking. So your discerning faculties start developing. Now, if you don't notice the spaces or the gaps, then your thinking process just becomes obsessive. You just go on and on and on. And even though you may not be thinking all the time, you're never conscious when you're not thinking. So we tend to obsess ourselves with thinking. And think. You know, when you first start meditating, people, you know, they have this, I want to teach me how to meditate, Ajahn Sumedho. And if you sit down now and just, you know, be aware of the breath, and let everything go. I'm giving very good advice. And at first they might feel a little calm, you know, like kind of guide them and soothe them a bit with soft words and good advice. And then I might leave and I'll say, I will now leave you now for half an hour and I shall return. And they come back now. And they say, I just think, you know. And they're trying to stop thinking by thinking that they shouldn't think. You know, you can't solve the problem that way. So that's where, like, the awareness, awareness, then you're aware of the thinking is like this, non-thinking is like this. And so, Zen Buddhism is very good at that, you know, where they keep using the like a koan or staring at a blank wall or something, where you there's nothing to kind of feed you. Or even if you're using a koan and you're thinking, you can't solve it through analysis or through reason. You know, it's absurd. It's nonsense, really, and yet you can be trying to make sense out of nonsense. You know, you've got a clever intellect. You can manipulate your thought patterns to even make a kind of sense out of nonsense. But that's not the point. It's not to be to find an answer or solve the koan, but to develop awareness. Of the thinking process, and of course, when your intellect is never satisfied, and the answers don't, you can't get the answer to the question. You know, you become, but your awareness increases. Then you begin to understand the desire to, you know, the desire to know the answer, that the discomfort you feel of not knowing something. How you don't like, you know, this feeling of insecurity, you know, how much we want to find security, even if it's based on false promises. Just tell me everything is okay. Everything is okay. I feel okay now. Even if everything isn't okay. Because, you know, on one level, I don't want to know what's wrong. And I can imagine all kinds of possibilities for everything going wrong. But recognizing emptiness or pure consciousness is not something I can create. It's through recognizing, knowing that you see for yourself. And so it's like this. And then, it's real. It's not. And like awareness, mindfulness, intuitive awareness. These words, you know, this is not dependent on conditions. You know, I don't need ideal conditions for this. You know, this kind of practice you can do. You know, you it connects you every moment. So in the middle of a shopping center or, you know, battlefield or mountaintop or whatever, in a meditation retreat or in the office, it's here now always. And as you trust it more, you know, you recognize it, trust it, then you begin to see the way of non-suffering. You know, and you gain confidence. You know, it's through knowing something, the reality, knowing reality, not through believing in me, what I say, or through Buddhist ideas anymore. But you know it. It's real. It's a fact. It's no longer a hoped for desired goal that you might fail at ever achieving if you start thinking about it.